And now, your daily dose of debate, breaking news, and uncensored views. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day, another great week in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great week, I hope, despite the fact that the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down at one point more than 400 points. Ouch. That's as the coronavirus fears rose everywhere. Travel stocks have slid. There is a real question about whether the Chinese government is even capable of handling this disaster and this threatened pandemic. Now it's over 3,000 people diagnosed and sickened, nearly 100 dead, and some predictions that the virus and its infections will be peaking around April or May, and perhaps with as many as 100, 150,000 new cases per week. Now, is this just alarmism? And why is it that this particular virus, this particular disease, so clearly exposes the limitations and the incompetence and the dictatorial nature, which doesn't really work when you're trying to deal with emergencies, of the Chinese regime? We'll be speaking with Gordon Chang about the entire matter and what it means for the future of the world economy. Impeachment drags on with the Bolton bombshell attracting a lot of attention. It's fascinating right now. The mainstream media seem to have shifted their breathless coverage of the ongoing impeachment trial to focus not on whether or not President Trump is going to be removed. He won't be removed. There is no way that the Democrats are going to get 20 Republicans to cross the aisle and vote with them. But they could get four. And so what does that mean? Well, then if they get four to vote for removal, they still lose. But if they get four to vote for calling witnesses, they'll have witnesses. Is there reason to be upset with the prospect of witnesses? We will deal with that coming up on the Michael Medved Show. We'll also be talking, of course, about the tragic news out of Southern California in Calabasas, where the great Kobe Bryant perished at age 41. And it is such a sad story. And it has hit the entire nation, actually the whole world, because there are fans for the NBA everywhere, including literally hundreds of millions of fans in China. And Kobe was one of those people who, because of his grace and his dignity and his eloquence, and because of his devotion to his family, frankly, actually transcended just mere sports. We'll talk a little bit about what that means with somebody else who have played big-time professional sports, 10 years in the NFL. That's Burgess Owens, who's also running for Congress in Utah. And he's running against a Utah congressman who supported impeachment. We'll talk to Burgess Owens about his take on that. And finally, we're also going to speak about a conclusion, and I think she's right, by Meghan Markle, that the Democratic strategy long-term for building their party is waiting for Trump supporters to die. Now, this doesn't mean that she expects you 25-year-old Trump supporters to die soon. She's just saying Democrats have noticed that Trump's strongest demographic is people over age 65. Why would that be anyway? We will get to that and much more on the Medved Show. But first up, the latest on impeachment. Let me say at the very outset, I have read a great deal. I have not actually seen John Bolton's book. Nobody really has, except for the various witnesses and sources the New York Times drew upon. And apparently it's a draft of his book. It's not even the final book. And as somebody who's done 14 books of my own, I can tell you sometimes there are very real differences between the first draft and the way the book ends up. In my case, most of what happens is stuff gets taken out because the book came in too long. Yeah, okay, I'm guilty to that. In terms of Bolton's book, the idea that everyone is trumpeting this as a game changer, I'll tell you where it could be a game changer, and it could be a game changer in terms of the demand for witnesses. But what about those witnesses? Impeachment manager Zoe Lofgren, a congresswoman from California, was on with Jake Tapper. And Jake, it seems to me, had the obvious and right question that he pushed her on. Is, okay, if these witnesses are so important, and that's where the issue appears to be right now, then how come the House didn't push to get those witnesses when they were doing their investigations? Listen.
Congresswoman, you told senators this week, quote, "Don't surrender to the president's stonewalling," unquote.
Right.
But what do you say to those who say that's what exactly what the House Democrats did by not going to court to try to force subpoenas and force witnesses?
We did go to court, as you know.
But you didn't pursue it in court. You ultimately withdrew the cases and
we
went
realized
to the
Senate. We had the evidence we were going to get and that it was sufficient to prove our case.
But didn't you surrender to the president's stonewalling in that sense?
Well, I guess in that sense we did, because if we had waited for 3 or 4 years, the election would be over. The issue would be almost moot. If he is committing a high crime and misdemeanor now and continuing to do it, we need to act.
She doesn't really answer the question. And by the way, their assumption is, of course, that it would be dragged out in court forever. It certainly would have been dragged out in court if they had pursued John Bolton as a witness for several more weeks. But why would that precisely be so costly? I mean, right now, we're in the midst of a very, very strange bit of timing. I mean, we are today, we're 1 week away, next Monday, Iowa caucuses. And it could be a truly shocking, world-changing result. If Joe Biden wins, I think Democrats are going to breathe a great big sigh of relief. But if you look at the numbers, and the numbers are coming in from Iowa, and it is fascinating, there appear to be three guys, and yes, they're all guys, who are bunched up very close at the top of the heap. And according to all reports from Iowa, both Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders have better ground games, which count for a lot in the caucuses, than Joe Biden. So it's a huge story if Pete Buttigieg wins the Iowa caucuses, because suddenly he becomes the new darling, the new Obama, which, of course, he's trying to capitalize on. He is going around saying what, 12 years ago, there was a young man who came to Iowa and nobody had heard of him and he had a funny name. Get it? Obama, Barack Hussein Obama, and Peter Buttigieg. They're both funny names. In any event, if Pete Buttigieg wins, it's a potential game changer. The polls show him ahead in New Hampshire right at the moment. And if he wins in Iowa and then New Hampshire, he's not going to win in South Carolina. And then we go to Super Tuesday. Well, there's Nevada in between, more caucuses. The point is, it is a complicated race, and everything is being upstaged, of course, by the ongoing impeachment discussion. And that will certainly be the case if they have additional witnesses. And that will certainly be the case if the Democrats insist on calling John Bolton and Michael Duffy and Mick Mulvaney, and the Republicans insist on calling Joe and Hunter Biden, or maybe the whistleblower, or maybe Adam Schiff. Who knows? But the point is, extending this melodrama is I don't think, particularly helpful to the Democrats. And yet, that is exactly what would be happening if they do vote to have witnesses. Mitt Romney said earlier today that he continues to lean toward the calling of witnesses. So did Susan Collins. Assuming that all 47 Democrats and the two independents aligned with Democrats, that they vote, the 45 Democrats and the two independents aligned with them, they get 47 votes that way. And then assuming that they get Mitt Romney, the senator from Utah, and Susan Collins, a senator from Maine, that means they only need two more Republican senators. And my guess is that, particularly with these latest Bolton revelations, they'll get them. But I don't understand why that's a big win for Democrats. What's fascinating to me is media are focusing on this right now. And I think it's almost compensatory because, of course, if you're on CNN or MSNBC or ABC, CBS, NBC, if you're on any network, any news outlet, you want the impeachment trial to be exciting, to have things about it that aren't slam dunk. The final vote, when they vote, you vote to remove President Trump from office, is slam dunk. And the vote will almost certainly be straight down party lines where it's 53 to 47. It could be 52 to 48. It could be 54 to 46, but it'll be really close. Not at all close to President Trump having the 67 votes against him that he would need to be removed from office. So what do you do if you're covering news and you want to keep it exciting and thrilling and keep people tuned in to long droning presentations? And you know what? I mean, again, these are competent lawyers on both sides. And I know Jay Sekulow had promised early on, the president's personal counsel, who is working with the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, to lead the presentation on the president's behalf. He had promised at one point, we're not going to subject you to the full 24 hours that we have, like the Democrats did. And that was the most popular thing that anybody has said. They're not supposed to be applauding anything in the Senate. But I think there was almost a standing ovation when he said that we're not going to be going a full 24 hours. They may be going a full 24 hours. And it's not going to change anything. But all of a sudden, they are now have this matter of witnesses where they could work for witnesses, where that would be more dramatic and that would be more newsworthy. So, of course, they're for it. But that doesn't mean that calling John Bolton as a witness or calling Mick Mulvaney as a witness, maybe it won't go well for John Bolton. Maybe it won't go well for Mick Mulvaney. But it's not going to change the final outcome with President Trump. Terry Moran at ABC News summarized basically the failure of the Democrats to actually shift things with their 24 hours of presentations. Listen.
Assessing where we are after 5 days of arguments.
You know, looking at it, it is a classic circumstantial evidence case, right? The Democrats come and they make a very meticulous, well-organized, and strong narrative argument that requires a leap to the conclusion that they did in their arguments. That if you look at these evidence around President Trump, he did this, and it warrants removal from office. And the Republicans, like any defense lawyer in trials across the country, every single day stand up and say, where's the direct evidence? That you have to make that conclusion, you have to make that leap. And that does raise the question, you know, was it the right choice at the end of the day for the Democrats to decide to go with this evidence, go with the impeachment you have, rather than fight, as they're now asking the Senate to do, for the people who could say, I was in the room, President Trump turned to me and said that money's not going to Ukraine unless they go after.
Okay, the point is that Bolton was in the room. So you have that. But I think, frankly, the Democrats are making a much better case, which is that where the Democrats fall down is they suggest that there were other motives that clearly involved his concept of national security and involved a sincere desire on the part of President Trump to get to the bottom of what he considered to be some mysteries in Ukraine that had nothing to do with hitting against Joe Biden. In other words, what the Democrats are unable, and I don't see any way that they actually can prove this, is to prove corrupt intent. And when it comes to the essence of this case, if they cannot prove corrupt intent, if President Trump may have actually pursued his policy with Ukraine and wanted this announcement of a special investigation of the CrowdStrike server and of Joe and Hunter Biden, If he had wanted that because he was concerned about whether this was really a change in Ukraine's corrupt government, well, that would be that would be exculpatory. In other words, if there are other explanations other than corrupt intent, then that gives Republican senators enough of what they need to follow their own inclinations and vote against removal of the president. And that's where we are. I don't believe that even if John Bolton testifies and says, yes, I spoke to the president and he said, no, he won't release this aid until they announce an investigation. Doesn't matter. He did release the aid, and they hadn't released they hadn't announced an investigation. So the entire thing at this point is gestural and people trying to score political points. And if you take a look at the national polling, it's true. There is, in most polls, there is a very slight majority of people who want to see the president removed from office. But you don't get 67 Senate votes with a slight majority. And the question is, will people look back on this entire process and these weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks as a worthy investment of time? President Trump spoke about John Bolton, and he was with Prime Minister Netanyahu. Now, this is actually more important news, who is here. So is his opponent in the Israeli elections, Benny Gantz. But he was standing beside Netanyahu when he was asked about John Bolton's manuscript. Listen.
Well, I haven't seen a manuscript, but I can tell you nothing was ever said to John Bolton. But I have not seen a manuscript. I guess he's writing a book. I have not seen it.
And neither have most people, including the New York Times people who wrote about the manuscript based upon what other people had told them. So this is third hand. President Trump also tweeted, I never told John Bolton that the aid to Ukraine was tied to investigations into Democrats, including the Bidens. In fact, he never complained about this at the time of his very public termination. If John Bolton said this, it was only to sell a book. That, by the way, I think is it may be true in terms of Bolton's motivation, but it's not true that this is an effective way to sell a book, because this book isn't coming out till September. And they moved it up to March now. OK, so it's coming out in March. Thank you. But having this amount of attention to the book and its big punchlines revealed right now probably won't help John Bolton in that regard. Let's go to Brown in Salton, Washington. Braun in Salton, Washington. You're on the MedVed Show.
Hey, I just wanted to make a mention that this must be the reason why Mrs. Pelosi waited so long to bring these articles of impeachment over, because they're waiting for John Bolton to finish writing his book. And it just seems to me, I'd like to see the timeline about that.
Well, that's an interesting concept. I don't think that Nancy Pelosi had advance notice that John Bolton was going to go against the president. And given the fact that Nancy Pelosi has been extraordinarily critical of John Bolton in the past, I think it's a little much to think that they're collaborating on this. Look, I think that for Ambassador Bolton, this is a difficult moment. Do I think it's possible that President Trump did say to him, don't release the aid until they announce an investigation? Well, based upon a lot of other things the president said to a lot of other people that they're testifying about, yeah. But the point is that a ground to remove him from office? We will get to that in the continuing debate. First, we're going to take a look at this crisis about the coronavirus and the prospect that it could become very, very serious within the next 5 months. How? Why? We'll talk to Gordon Chang coming up on the MedVed Show. Alarmism is a real problem around the world, particularly on the left. We've got some new examples of that from Al Gore, who's back, and we will get to that. But it doesn't appear to be alarmism that is suggesting that the coronavirus in China and potentially spreading well beyond China is attracting very, very serious attention, not just from Chinese authorities, but from medical experts around the world. Gordon G. Chang, and you can follow him on Twitter, and you should. He's at Gordon G. Chang. It's that at Gordon G. Chang, all one word, of course. Gordon G. Chang has written about China before and predicted the collapse at some point in the future, not tomorrow, of the current regime. Gordon, how has the dictatorial, authoritarian nature of this regime contributed to this horrible problem right now?
Well, Michael, this is in a sense like Chernobyl, where you have the Soviet authorities trying to cover up the explosion at that nuclear station. And that, of course, contributed to the problems later on because people were not able to take effective measures. Well, the same thing is now occurring with the coronavirus in Wuhan, which is now spread beyond Hubei province and now has consumed the entire country. The first case was diagnosed December 8th, but as late as last Tuesday, you had Hubei provincial officials holding a public gala in Wuhan for Lunar New Year. The day before that, Monday, they had hosted somewhere between 10 and 40,000 people at a banquet in order to get into the Guinness World Book of Records. And then we find that they get to Wednesday or Thursday, and finally they admit what's going on. But they did cover this up, and they covered it up at a period where they could have done something to stop the spread. And right now, the numbers that are coming out on infections in China are just beyond belief.
Well, you mentioned, we are talking off the air for a moment, you mentioned 44,000. I had heard 2,800, which is, I think, the government statement, but there are now credible reports there. It's already 44,000 victims?
Yes, that's from a University of Hong Kong team. They estimated that in Wuhan alone as of last Saturday. And because this is highly contagious, the number of people infected there now has to be much higher. It is believed that each infected person will infect somewhere between, I think it's 2.8 and 3.6 other people, and that is off the charts high. So you can see how this thing has spread. Last Wednesday...
And they don't have the facilities to treat these people, as I understand it.
No, they don't. We saw those images of the hospital in Wuhan, which were just crowded with people seeking attention. And on the floor were corpses, which had been there for half a day or more, because medical personnel did not have the time to clear away the dead. To show you how fast these numbers are increasing, last Wednesday, a number that many people thought was alarming and could not be true was 6,000 infections in Wuhan. But that number is probably quite low. You had a nurse in Wuhan say, well, there are 90,000 people infected, and that was like Thursday. And I thought that was just impossibly high, but perhaps not.
Okay, they are now reporting, and you probably have seen this, that the scientists have identified two possible root causes for the coronavirus. And number one is the consumption of wildlife, such as bats in Wuhan, and then also the potential leak of the virus at a well-protected center, at a laboratory. Have they been able to stop the consumption of bats? First of all, I didn't know that eating bats was a thing, but there are pictures of people apparently in Wuhan, a city of 11 million, eating bats. What's the deal there?
Well, the Chinese have eaten almost everything. As they say, that if you got the back to the sky, the Chinese will eat it. This has been something that's gone on for quite some time and has been a source of these viral infections. But they've continued these wet markets, and obviously this is going to have to end, as much as that will cause grief to many Chinese gourmets. But the problem here is that this is a method of transmission. You also referred to that P4 lab, level 4 lab, which is the most secure type of facility. That is about 20 miles away from the wet market that many people first suspected as being the source of the pathogen. But now there are conspiracy theories, there are rumors, all sorts of reporting that people are suspecting that there might have been a leak from that P4 lab where Beijing has basically got a biochemical, biological weapons program. So there's a lot going on. And there's also this report, which probably isn't significant, but nonetheless is catching people's attention, about the Canadian authorities detaining a Chinese husband and wife for sending pathogens illicitly from Canada to that Wuhan lab. So there's a lot of discussion out there. The point about these theories, though, it doesn't matter whether they're true or not. What they are doing are fueling rumors in China, and there is going to be recrimination once this pathogen tends to die out, which, as you point out, could very well be months and months from now if it's peaking in April and May.
I'm speaking to Gordon Chang. You can keep up with him on Twitter, and it's important to do so. It's at Gordon Chang on Twitter, at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. Gordon, you mentioned Chernobyl before, and a lot of historians about the end of the Cold War talk about the Chernobyl incident as one of the great blows that brought down the Soviet Union, because it showed the regime as bumbling, incompetent. I mean, what's the point of an authoritarian regime if you can't protect people from a nuclear contamination? And what's the point of an authoritarian regime if you have a coronavirus that is just out of control?
Yes, and China is moving swiftly. Even before the outbreak of this virus, China was moving swiftly from an authoritarian regime to a totalitarian one. Not all the way there yet. But what we have seen over the last two or three days with these quarantines, lockdowns on 60 million people, is that China actually does maintain the mechanisms of totalitarian control. And therefore, they are able to isolate whole populations, now estimated to be 60 million people on some form of travel restrictions. And some of them are under a total travel ban. So right now, we have a China leadership which is desperate to try to do something. And what they have chosen is the harshest things possible.
Do you buy the idea that it's actually news of this virus that has been devastating for U.S. markets and the world economy recently?
Apparently, that has affected some of the market behavior. You know, I think the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which has been setting new records every day, it seems, many market analysts were saying that it had to top out sometime. That's not a consensus view, but many people have been saying that. So you had to have just any sort of rumor or little factoid could change market sentiment. What we saw this morning was the market dropped something like the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 549 points on the opening. It's bounced back since then. But what we have obviously witnessed was this did affect market sentiment as people understood that this would have an enormous effect, devastating effect on the Chinese economy and ripple effects around the world.
The Chinese economy is struggling anyway. Follow Gordon Chang on his Twitter account at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. We will be right back on the Medved Show with more on the takeaways from the so-called Bolton bombshell. Okay, it's at least alliteration, right? You can say Bolton bombshell. We'll get to that and much more on the Medved Show. Okay, a question about why this virus in China should have such a worldwide impact and such a profound impact on the U.S. economy. There was film of the closing until further notice, and it may be going on indefinitely. They closed. I mean, shut down. Closed the doors. The Disneyland in Shanghai, which is, I believe, one of the most profitable of all the Disney venues. In any event, the Happiest Kingdom is not so happy over in China, but they're not alone. and being unhappy in China. Here in the United States, there's a piece just published just moments ago by Fred Flights. And Fred Flights is a longtime colleague of John Bolton. He is the president of the Center for Security Policy, served in 2018 as deputy assistant to the president and to the chief of staff of the National Security Council. In other words, he worked with him in the Obama administration. He says, it was crushing to read weekend press reports that my friend and former boss, John Bolton, plans to publish a tell-all book on his time as President Trump's national security advisor. The book reportedly will be published in March of this year. Given the importance of protecting a president's confidential discussions with his senior advisors, I strongly disagree with Bolton's decision to release the book before the November presidential election and call on him to withdraw it from the publisher immediately. I've known John Bolton for 30 years, he writes, and served as chief of staff twice at the State Department from 2001 to 2005. That was under President Bush, of course, and at the White House, National Security Council in 2018. He's an exceptional national security expert and a man of great integrity. President Trump's choice of Bolton was one of his best personnel decisions, and I was very sorry when the courageous and visionary national security advisor left the White House after the relationship broke down. Okay, this is somebody who obviously has respect for both President Trump and for Ambassador Bolton. And one of the takeaways here is that I don't think either man gains in any way if they end up basically in a an argument about who's telling the truth. Part of the problem for the president is that over the weekend, they released the tape, and it's videotape. It's not just audio. They released the videotape that Lev Parnas had taken of President Trump at a fundraiser. And what was amazing, he didn't just promise that he would fire Ambassador Yovanovitch, and he did so with great eagerness, just based upon what Lev Parnas had told him about, oh, she's going around saying you should be impeached. Now, I personally believe that's very doubtful. I don't think that's true. And again, there are reasons that Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman and Rudy Giuliani all had business interests that were being stepped on by Marie Yovanovitch, and so they wanted to get rid of her. And it's also incredibly weird. In the tape, President Trump says, yeah, get rid of her. Get rid of her right now. I want her gone. And 14 months later, she was still there. So either you have the president changed his mind about that, or more likely his associates, he called over an associate who I think has been still unidentified and told him, I want to fire her. President can fire an ambassador anytime he wants, but it doesn't work if you forget about it after you've told an assistant, and the assistant says, oh, that's just a silly idea. That's President Trump being President Trump. The situation is not good. It does not reflect well in any way on any of the participants here, not on Lev Parnas, not on Donald J. Trump, not on Rudy Giuliani, not on John Bolton, et cetera, et cetera. The New York Times, which broke this story, has five takeaways from a book that could complicate Trump's impeachment trial. It could prolong it. It's not going to complicate it that much, in my opinion. New York Times writes, Mr. Trump tied his willingness to release aid to Ukraine on investigations he sought. Okay, so what is the question? Yes, it would indicate that the president has been less than forthcoming. That could be problems in what exactly he remembers. It seems to me it's not going to lead to those 20 Republican votes that they would need to get. Number two takeaway, Mr. Trump was at odds with his senior national security officials. Well, duh, we knew that at the time that Bolton was fired. And he's not just at odds with his national security officials about Ukraine. The Times points out that according to Bolton's book, both Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Defense Secretary Mark T. Esper joined Bolton in pressing Trump to release the aid in the weeks leading up to the August meeting. The point is, that he did release the aide shortly thereafter, though only after the whistleblower had filed his complaint and the entire code of silence, screen of silence, had appeared to unravel. And then takeaway number three, Mr. Bolton says he talked to Barr and Pompeo about Giuliani. They both deny it, by the way. And Mr. Bolton wrote that Mr. Pompeo privately acknowledged to him last spring that Mr. Giuliani's claims about Marie Yovanovitch had no basis, including allegations that she was bad-mouthing Mr. Trump. Mr. Pompeo suggested to Mr. Bolton that Mr. Giuliani may have wanted Ms. Yovanovitch out because she might have been targeting his business clients in her anti-corruption efforts. Mr. Pompeo lashed out at a National Public Radio host on Friday and Saturday after she asked him in an interview about Ms. Yovanovitch's removal. This is obviously a sensitive point with Secretary Pompeo. NPR reporter's name is Mary Louise Kelly. It also turns out the final two points, the takeaways from the New York Times, Mr. Bolton is willing to testify. The White House doesn't want him to. Neither one is exactly news. We've known that Bolton is willing to testify. And here, by the way, it probably will hurt his book sales in March if his book is thoroughly discussed during impeachment trial in February. I mean, everybody knows about John Bolton's book anyway, even before it's discussed. The manuscript introduced a significant twist to the impeachment trial. A twist only in the sense that I think it increases the likelihood, not to be a sure thing by any means, but it increases the likelihood that there will be the votes to go forward with witnesses. I think that Peggy Noonan is right. Now, Joe Biden has said that there is no way that he is going to testify. Peggy Noonan urged Joe Biden to testify and said that could make him president. I think if he were up to the challenge, and the challenge would be answering questions from the president's legal team, not from the senators. But I believe that Joe Biden would look bigger, not smaller. I think that his willingness to testify will depend upon, to some extent, the Iowa caucuses, which are also happening. We will bring you the latest. The Democratic Party, I think the only thing to compare this to, the prospect of Bernie Sanders actually winning the nomination, and there are a lot of smart people. Frank Luntz was on this radio show 6 months ago, and Frank said he thought Bernie was going to be the nominee. And I thought, Frank, come on, you're using substances that are, well, at that time, legal only in Washington and Colorado. But he may turn out to have been right. So what is the deal with this Bernie campaign and with the Democratic campaign to hang on until Trump supporters all go to the great beyond? We will continue the conversation. And also getting rid of art history, because art history is too white and too Western. Yeah, that's what they're doing at Yale, alas. We will get to that and much, much more in this greatest nation on God's green earth.